And with that new kingdom, there are a couple interesting points to look at concerning this idea of a new kingdom for this particular section. This section mentions a few interesting things, including it mentions the kingdom. The 12 apostles are appointed here in this particular passage a little bit later on in chapter 3. In chapter 4, we see parables about the kingdom. And so we see that this particular section, chapter 3, verse 7 through chapter 6, verse 6, represent a new kingdom. And so we are looking at that thing as well. When we start off, though, we note that his popularity and the conflict that he has been facing have actually caused him to withdraw. So he wants to withdraw here, and we do see this here in Mark chapter 3, verses 7 through 12. And if someone would read that, please, that would be helpful.
Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and from beyond the Jordan and from around Tyre and Sidon. When the great crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him, and he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed many, so that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God," and he strictly ordered them not to make him known.
All right. So, again, with his continued popularity and the plotting that had been done against him, he decides it's time to withdraw. And there's an indication here that he withdraws to the Sea of Galilee because it says, "Make a small boat ready for me." And so he does this particular thing, and he's constantly accosted by people. As we see a little bit later on in this chapter, that is very much the case. People from all corners of the region come to see Jesus, and that's kind of what I want to pull up on the PowerPoint, is showing where all these people are coming from, where all these places are that are talked about. And those places we note are in Galilee, Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and those beyond the Jordan, and Tyre and Sidon. And that's pretty remarkable that his fame and his popularity has been able to reach all these places. Of course, it's not amazing that it's reached Galilee because he's in Galilee. It's not that amazing that it's reached Judea and Jerusalem because we do know that the Pharisees and the Sadducees have heard about his goings on. But what is amazing is that Tyre and Sidon, the areas beyond the Jordan, these places are actually hearing about him. So now would be a good time for the lights. Yeah. So this being chapter 3 is the word clock for chapter 3. This is a map of the area. You're familiar with the area, I'm sure. This is, of course, a map of the area in modern day. So I have the satellite view so that it's not, we don't clearly see all the borders, because, of course, the borders are different than they are than they were back then. But they come from all over the place. Presumably, he's in Capernaum, or at least very near it. And he's in that area of the Sea of Galilee. So I have a red dot there for that particular spot. But we have Galilee right there, that area of Galilee. We have Judea and Jerusalem. We have, those are the Jewish areas, Galilee, Judea, and Jerusalem. We have Idumea. Who are the Idumeans? Do you remember? Yeah, the Idumeans, that's the Greek term for the Edomites. So these are the descendants of Esau, right? Esau and Jacob and Esau, right? Jacob, the descendants of Jacob are the Israelites, later on the Jews. And the Idumeans are the descendants of Esau. So that's what we have here in the more southern areas of Palestine. And then it says areas beyond the Jordan. Now that could mean all manner of areas, but we see that there are several different provinces over here that could apply. Yes?
Well, I was just curious, is this about the area of, like, from Charlotte to here or here to Tennessee? How big is it?
I think the area of Israel is about the size of New Jersey, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
It's about 60 miles from Jerusalem to Galilee. I remember it took 2 to 3 days walking to do it.
Yeah, it's a lot of walking.
If you look at that being about 50 to 60 miles from where Jerusalem is at the top of the Dead Sea up to Galilee.
Yeah.
So you got people from literally 100 miles. That's over 100, 150 miles across.
Oh, yeah.
And about 200 miles tall. So they were coming from a long way away.
And many of them were by foot. I'm sure most of them were by foot, and they're coming to hear this Jesus. And we see areas of Perea here, of Decapolis here, I think Galanitis and Trachonitis. There's a whole bunch in this area. And then Ituria over here. So different areas, the names of the different places that Mark just labels areas beyond the Jordan. And so that's what we see here. And then we see Tyre and Sidon. Right here. Now that is particularly interesting because that is a completely Gentile area. The Phoenicians don't have much relationship with Jews and Judaism, not like the Edomites do, because they're connected through Isaac, right? Isaac, Jacob, and Esau. But even the people from Tyre and Sidon. Now, that's remarkable that even these Gentiles are wanting to hear the message of Jesus that he has to say, the things that he has to say. All right, one of the things that we notice is that they come from all directions, don't they? They come from north, south, east, and about as west as you can get because you're near the coast. So that's another fascinating thing that we note here. All right. The crowds were so strong that he was worried that he would be crushed. That passage, verse 9, I think, if I remember, ESV words it a little bit differently, what Alvin was reading from. But it says that in the last phrase there of verse 9, lest they should crush him. He was worried that they was going to be crushed. So he asked his disciples to make a small boat, have a small boat ready. That particular word for crush means they might press hard upon him as one would press grapes. And that's rough. Yes?
If you've never been in a crowd, I once went to, when I was a young man, I went to what was going to be a rock concert at the Cotton Bowl, Reed Stadium. And in the morning, there were tens of thousands of people lined up to get in. And all of a sudden, a stampede started toward the gate. And there were two young ladies under me. I was holding myself up to keep from crushing them, and there were people piled on top of me. And everyone was screaming and hollering, and people were killed. There was just power moving. You couldn't resist it. People pushing. It's a pretty scary situation. And when you think about, this wasn't a quiet congregational setting, right?
Yeah.
People were sitting going, oh, let's go listen to Jesus. Hey, be quiet over there. We're trying to hear. They're fighting to get to him. Thousands.
They're desperate. I think this is a sign of their desperation. He's having a small boat kept ready, and I have on here that it says it's sort of an escape route. If it's needed to get him out of there, it's sort of an escape route to help him out. But I don't think he actually uses it, at least not in this particular passage. They all want to touch him, it says. They all want to touch him, thinking that they would be healed. And in fact, this does happen in chapter 5. In chapter 5, we read about the woman who touches the hem of his garment. In Mark, it records, touches his clothes. But the idea is they think that if they just touch him, they'll be healed. And it's true, that does happen. We know it happens later on, and it very, very likely happens at this point as well. And I think it points to their desperation. They're desperate to be healed because, you know, they've likely had all these illnesses for their whole life, and they're just desperate for that kind of thing. And we talked about that when we talked about his popularity before. But the interesting thing to note is that the attacks of the Pharisees haven't hurt his popularity at all with the common person. And so, you know, it might not have hurt him, it might have even helped him become more popular because he's able to withstand all these attacks that the Pharisees and the scribes are giving to him. Again, we see in verses 11 and 12 that the demons identify Jesus while he insists that they not reveal who he is. Now, we've talked about this before, so I don't want to belabor this point too much, but we note that the demons once again confess him. Again, earlier Mark identified him as the Son of God in chapter 1, verse 1. The Father did in the baptism of Jesus, and many of the other demons did as well. We see this in chapter 1 several times, and we see this here in chapter 3. But it was not time yet for him to be revealed. Perhaps the Pharisees would be all the more diligent to find ways to kill him. We see later that the scribes from Jerusalem would accuse him of casting out demons by the ruler of the demons, later on in verse 22. Perhaps they didn't hear what the demons said about Jesus. Or maybe they didn't listen. Maybe they thought, the demon says he's the Holy One of God. That means it can't be true. Maybe that's their thought. I don't know.
And they say later that, you know, he just casts out demons by the prince of demons.
Yeah, yeah.
They try to make that argument.
Yeah. All right. So that was actually a pretty quick section right there. Not a whole lot to talk about except for all the people coming in and all the things that his continued popularity. Any comments or thoughts before we go on to the disciples?
There's one thing to think about. With all these people coming, and he's healing lots of people. So yeah, a lot of sick people are coming, right? There's a whole bunch of sick people going in, and then they're healed, and they're going back home. So you have this wave of healed people all coming back out into the countries where they're going, telling everybody. If you were on the road, if you were on the main road, you would have, every now and then, there'd be another person come by and say, I couldn't walk, and look at me now, or I had a demon, or my child was sick, or whatever. And so the message is just growing like wildfire.
I'm sure some of them were going home, but as we see in Acts 2, we note that a lot of them stayed in Jerusalem in Acts 2. So I think that it's very likely that a lot of people were coming to be healed by Jesus and then listening to what he had to say. And we do see this also in John 6, where he's there and he gives them all bread and in the feeding of the 5,000, and then he says something, that he teaches something that they consider kind of hard to hear, and a lot of them leave. But even so, here he hasn't quite said those things yet that are hard to hear. He said things that really resonate with people, and his teaching does that. And as we see, we haven't really seen much of his teaching here in Mark yet, but we'll see that more in chapter 4. There is some teaching, of course, earlier on, but in spurts here or there, little things that we can gather from the earlier passages. All right, so yes.
So when he had this gathering, he wasn't doing much teaching. He was just doing healing.
No, I believe he was doing a lot of teaching.
It's just not recorded.
It's just not recorded here in Mark what his teachings were, because Matthew records a lot of it in the Sermon on the Mount. Luke records a lot of it. John records several passages of some of the teaching that he had. And then we do get a little bit of what is recorded later on in chapter 4 about his teachings. It does say that he's teaching, because it does say that his purpose was to preach the gospel. And so part of that is it's just not recorded here in Mark. Yeah? Go ahead. I saw your hand up.
No, I was still thinking on the other.
Okay.
People all around, most people knew that he was the Son of God, and anybody could say that and identify him as the Son of God. But the moment that he said, "I am the Son of God," that could be taken as blasphemy, because he was claiming to, you know, be God, the Son of God. And then that was an offense that they could kill him for.
Yeah.
So if he never claimed to be until the time was right.
Well, he did call himself the Son of Man in several places already. And we haven't talked about that because we haven't had time, and it felt like I'd be chasing a rabbit. But he does use the term Son of Man a couple times, and he has already. And the Son of Man is a phrase hearkening back to something that was said in Daniel chapter 7. And that is a clear reference. And we can turn there if we want to take that time. But Daniel chapter 7, when it says Son of Man, it's a clear reference to the Messiah. And so that is likely something that he is referencing. However, it might not have necessarily been clear to the Pharisees that that's what he was talking about. And so they're not ready to get him just yet.
But over the 3 years that he was preaching, at some point he was
made clear. That's right. It was made clear. Because I don't think people really knew that he was the Son of God at first. We see that God the Father affirmed it at his baptism, but even John the Baptist doubted a little bit later on. I don't remember if we see that in Mark, but we do see that in Matthew at least, that he doubted, are you really the one that was sent? Are you really the Son of God? That kind of thing. And so even John the Baptist had a moment of doubt. So I don't think it was entirely clear to everyone. Not even the disciples believed, and that's one of the things that we'll that we point out here in chapter 6, verse 6 of Mark, because the disciples weren't even sure. It wasn't until the end of chapter 8, I believe, that it was a little bit more clear. I think it's 6:6. Not 6:6. That's his hometown. That's the next section. That his disciples are not even sure. But we will look at who those 12 disciples are now. I have a list up here of the lists, a list of lists of the apostles. John doesn't have a set list. I mean, he talks about several of them, but he doesn't have a list like the other gospel accounts do. The latter two feels almost like a cheat because they're written by the same person. Luke 6:14 through 16 and Acts 1:13. Both written by Luke. Then we see Matthew's and Mark's. And it's interesting to see some of the characteristics. They're put in order of the order that's given in their accounts. And I'll point out who the same person is, because sometimes it's not entirely clear. So, yes?
So the guys on the left are the same as the guys on the right?
No, not necessarily. Pardon?
This is the order of mention?
Yes, this is the order of mention. So they are the same. Everyone mentioned is the same as... they're all the same list, all the same people. Looking at Bartholomew, there on Matthew, it's mentioned Bartholomew, Thomas in Acts. But Acts, they're not the same person. Bartholomew is mentioned in the next one.
But in all, I mean, the way you have it listed here, that whenever they list the apostles, Peter was listed first.
Always,
and
yeah.
A couple of them, Andrew was listed first, and a couple James, or second, and a couple James was listed, you know, second.
Third.
John was down there. This is the order when they were mentioned. And like Judas is always the last.
Judas Iscariot, yeah.
Right. So it's not meant that the same person you see over here is supposed to be the same person to the left.
Oh. Yeah. But and we'll go through it right now just because, you know, that's what we're here for, right? Mm-hmm. All right. So somebody read verses 13 through 19, please.
And he went up on the mountain and called to him those he himself wanted. And they came to him. And then he appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have power to heal sicknesses and to cast out demons. Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the names Boanerges, that is, the sons of thunder, Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. And they went into the house.
All right. So, looking at these first few verses, 13 through 15, Jesus, he managed to find his way from the crowd to go up a mountain with 12 of his followers. As you might imagine, with so many people coming and crushing him, as it were, he has several followers. In fact, he says that several of his followers, some of his disciples, he asked to prepare a small boat. And so he's developed some of these followers. We've already seen five of these be called. We've seen Peter, Andrew, James, John, and Matthew called. We've seen them earlier in this book, chapter 1 and also chapter 2 for some of them. So, but they've already, several others have come up and have followed Jesus. And so he's gathered 12 of his followers and said, you're the guys. Come on, you're going to be the disciples here. Out of his followers, there was this inner circle of 12. And out of those 12, there were three who were even closer to Jesus, and these were the first three that are mentioned in Mark, Peter, James, and John. Luke mentions that he prayed all night before this big decision. He prayed all night before deciding who these 12 were going to be. These 12 men are reminiscent of the 12 patriarchs. So we see these 12 men here. We also note that Jacob had 12 sons and 12 tribes of Israel. And so with these apostles, or these disciples here that are named, these 12, we see sort of a mirroring of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and in a sense, a new kingdom that he's establishing here with these 12 men. They too had a directive to be sent out as apostles. That's what that word means. Apostello means it means to send out, which is the word that is used here. They might send them out to preach, apostello, which is in the noun form apostolos, which we get the word apostle. Just like we don't know a whole lot about Zebulun, Asher, and Issachar, we don't know a whole lot about many of these that are mentioned. But we know a little bit about some of those, particularly by their names, and we'll talk about them because many of them aren't mentioned anywhere else in the scripture. All right. They were also given the power to perform miracles, we see in verse 15. They were to preach in verse 14, and in verse 15, they had the power to heal sicknesses and to cast out demons. So, thought question before we move on to this. Were they baptized in the Holy Spirit here? No, they were not. They were not. They were just granted gifts of the Holy Spirit before they were baptized in the Spirit. And so to have the ability to perform miracles does not necessarily mean you've been baptized in the Spirit. because that doesn't happen until Acts chapter 2. All right. Again, this was to confirm the word that they were preaching. That's the purpose of miracles, to confirm the word. All right, let's consider the 12.
Is the 70 mentioned in Mark? Sending out of the 70?
No, I don't think so. I think that's mainly in Luke.
Case where here it's the same bunch minus Judas who's in Acts 2.
Yeah.
When you know, they all speak in tongues and everything else. But there were 70 that Jesus sends out in his ministry, and they were all given that same power.
Yeah.
And say, I'll go out and heal the sick, raise the dead, do all kinds of things.
So he's got the 70 followers, and then the 12 even closer, and then the 3 even closer. But those 3, those 70 aren't, I don't think they're mentioned in Mark. I think it's only in Luke that they're talked about. But
would you repeat that the purpose of miracles
is to confirm the word that they taught, that they preached? Yeah. All right. The first one on here is Simon Peter. He gets the most airtime, as it were. He gets the most mentions. He's talked about the most. In fact, the first half, practically, of the book of Acts, it's funny. It's the full name of the book of Acts is Acts of the Apostles. But really, it's the Acts of Peter in the first 12 chapters and the Acts of Paul in the rest of the book. But we do see them mentioned a few other times. Sometimes James is mentioned, sometimes John is mentioned. So we do see a couple other mentions as well. But Peter, really, he's one of the main people here. Even though Andrew, his brother, introduces Peter to Jesus, Peter gets the first mention here. He becomes one of the most prominent of the original 12. Even given the keys of the kingdom, we see in Matthew 16 and verse 18. He's given the keys of the kingdom, which he uses to open up the kingdom to the Jews in Acts chapter 2 and to the Gentiles in Acts chapter 10. While Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles, it was Peter who first preached to them. And they were able to become Christians at that point. All right, so James and John are mentioned up here. These are the sons of Zebedee, which we've talked about already a little bit, because among those who were mentioned as were called, James and John were among them. These three, Peter, James, and John, end up being in the inner circle, or the inner circle of Jesus' disciples. Jesus gives them the nickname Boanerges, the sons of thunder. And for some reason, it's only mentioned here that this was a nickname that they were given, Boanerges, the sons of thunder. It's not entirely clear why this particular nickname was given, but it could indicate, some commentators and people thinking about this have thought that perhaps it's because they wanted to call fire upon Samaritan villages who wouldn't listen to their message. We see this later on in Luke chapter 9, verses 51 through 56. And so the possibility is there that this was the case. But it's not, but of course that happens later, and so Jesus would have had to have anticipated this particular thing if he gave them this nickname by this point.
I was wondering about, of course, they were the sons of the same father who was a fisherman.
Yeah.
Jesus called them when they were fishing because they said they left their nets immediately. Right? Uh-huh. So he may have known his dad. He might have had a fig mouth dad. Who knows? But what I find fascinating is whatever the reason that he calls them this, we have a lot of John written in the Bible, right? A lot of his speaking. And especially, I mean, you don't see in the Gospel of John a strong, powerful messenger, John. He's telling the story. You know, yeah. He's focusing on Jesus. When you get to the letters of John, he's older. He's just gentle. You know, you're gentle and love is his message and all this stuff. It's hard to see him as a son of thunder. You know, you don't know what he was like when he was a young man.
Yeah, and with all of these, we don't know what they were like beforehand. I mean, we do see Peter at most have this progression from this impetuous, loudmouthed individual to being one of the leading apostles in the church. And so his transformation through this time might not just be his transformation, but the transformation of all these people. And we can see that evidenced later on with some of these other apostles as well. James, he's the first one of the 12 to die as a martyr. We see, of course, in Acts chapter 12, verse 2. And John outlived them all by dying of natural causes. And we note that in or at least it's alluded to in John chapter 21, verses 20 through 23. All right, so the next one, Andrew. Yes.
Well, it's John. Now, John here is not the John of Revelations.
No, he is.
Oh, he is?
Yes.
So that's later when John's old.
Older, yeah. Yes, okay. Yep. So John writes 5 books of the Bible. He writes the Gospel of John, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, and Revelation. This James doesn't write any of the Bible. There is a book called James, but we'll talk about that in a second, because I want to talk about that when we look at James, the son of Alphaeus. So James doesn't write anything. As far as we know, we're pretty certain, having died in Acts chapter 12, and the date of the book of James is around the time, is believed to be around the time of Acts 15, roughly. So it would make sense that it wasn't James, the son of Zebedee, who wrote the book of James. So we have Andrew. He gets the first mention of those after Peter, James, and John. Of course, he is Peter's brother and a former disciple of John the Baptist. So he has this prominent position earlier on, and yet, in fact, two of the other accounts list him as second, because he was one of the first apostles to have been called. We can see that in John chapter 1. We can see that also in Mark chapter 1, that we talked about that already. That Peter and Andrew were called at about the same time. And then we see James and John called at the same time. And then we see Philip. Again, not much is mentioned about him. All we know, he's mentioned in John chapter 1. He was from Bethsaida and introduced Nathanael to Jesus. We see this in John chapter 1, verses 43 through 46. This is not the same Philip that we see in Acts chapter 6 or Acts chapter 8, or I think there's another mention of him later on in the book of Acts. Where it's mentioned that that particular Philip has 4 daughters. This is not the same Philip. That Philip, in Acts chapter 8, he was chosen, well, prominently mentioned in Acts chapter 8, but in Acts chapter 6, he's chosen with 6 other brethren to be servants at that time. Some will say that they're deacons, and I'm convinced of that, but some don't, you know. But it's that these 7 were called, including Stephen and Philip. Those are the two more famous of the 7. And so that is not the same Philip. And that's clear because he's not numbered with the other apostles. This is a different Philip. So we don't know much about this particular Philip. Philip means one who loves horses. I don't know why I decided to mention that. It's not my notes. I just remember that from Greek class. But anyway, Bartholomew is the next one on here. He is believed to actually be Nathanael, the same person. And I think that's mainly from tradition. But John talks about him and says that in John chapter 21, verse 2, that Nathanael was from Cana of Galilee. What famous thing happened in Cana? Where Jesus turned water to wine, right? That's where that particular thing occurs, and that's where Nathanael is from. His name means, Bartholomew means son of Tolmai, which could indicate that his full name was Nathanael, son of Tolmai. Nathanael Bartholomew, because if you remember, Bar, B-A-R, is sort of an Aramaic indication that this is son of. Barnabas is one of those. He's the son of encouragement. Barabbas is son of a father.
This is about as generic a title as you can give anybody.
Right, right. Barabbas.
That's yeah. Like we would see in our languages, like Anderson, right?
Remember yeah. We see son of, the
son of man, yeah.
That it's that same, that's the same derivation yeah. Eventually was the son of so-and-so.
Yeah, Anderson means son of a man. It means basically the same thing as Barabbas. All right, so Nathanael, he was initially skeptical of Jesus, but was fairly easily convinced in John chapter 1, verses 47 through 51. All Jesus had to say was, I saw you under the fig tree. And he said, you believed after just that? You'll see much greater things than this. Matthew, we note in chapter 2, verse 14, he was formerly known as Levi, the son of Alphaeus. He was a tax collector called by Jesus, and his name, Matthew, means gift of God, and could have been attributed to him after he encountered Jesus. And he could be the brother of James, the son of Alphaeus, because they have, their fathers appear to have the same name. So Thomas is Aramaic for twin. In John, a couple places, if you're looking at the King James, it says Thomas Didymus, which is Thomas. Didymus is Greek for twin. So, it's the same kind of thing. Thomas the twin. And he also has a reputation of being skeptical because his skepticism was after Jesus' earthly ministry. But then he had witnessed all the wonders that Jesus had performed, and he was privy to all of his teachings, and yet he still didn't believe that Jesus had risen from the dead when he was told. He had to see it for himself. And he even mentioned he has to put his fingers in his wounds to prove to him that Jesus had really risen from the dead. And then, of course, Jesus makes a great point that there are those who believe and have not seen are more blessed than those who have seen. All right, then we see James, the son of Alphaeus. There are three prominent Jameses mentioned in the New Testament. James, the son of Zebedee, which we've talked about already. James, the brother of Jesus, which we haven't talked about yet, but we will in a little bit. Well, next week, obviously. And James, the son of Alphaeus. All right, so three prominent Jameses in the New Testament. Tradition calls them other things out of shorthand. James the Great, or James the Greater, James the son of Zebedee. James the Just, James the brother of Jesus. And James the Less, James the brother, or James the son of Alphaeus. If he is James the Less, if there is that connection there, then he's mentioned later in Mark 15, verses 40 and 41, where his mother is a follower of Jesus. So if he is James the Less, then his mother is also clearly a follower and witnessed the crucifixion.
Can you say that last two sentences again? I kind of missed it.
So James the Less is a person who's mentioned in Mark chapter 15, and his mother, Mary, not the same Mary as Jesus' mother, but a different Mary. Mary was a popular name back then. Is the one who witnessed the crucifixion, along with several other women. Okay. So James the Less's mother witnessed that, and there is that connection. A lot of people say that James the Less is the same as James the son of Alphaeus. Although there's no direct connection between those scripturally. So it's possible that this is the same person. All right. Thaddeus is perhaps one of the more interesting, at least in terms of names, because as you know, Thaddeus isn't mentioned in all of them. So what's the deal? Thaddeus, his first name, as we see in Matthew's account, was Levius. Levius, whose surname was Thaddeus. But he was called Judas, the son of James, by Luke. John calls him Judas, not Iscariot. He's mentioned in John chapter 14, verse 22. And so Thaddeus has this other name. Judas Judas is actually also a very common name back then. So when we call someone a Judas, we're talking about Judas Iscariot, but really that's the Greek form of the word Judah. And also we see Jude is part of that as well. So one of Jesus' brothers is called Judas, often shortened to Jude, and that's another book of the Bible that we have. All right, Simon the Canaanite, we've got two more. I think we can do it. Simon the Canaanite, a better translation or a better way of looking at it is Simon the Canaanean. I think the King James does translate it that way. This is not, as you might expect, the word for one who is from Canaan. That's not what this means. This is an Aramaic word which means enthusiast or zealot. So the Greek word in Luke's account is Simon the Zealot. So there's no contradiction between these. We see Simon the Canaanite or the Canaanean in Matthew and Mark, and Simon called Zealot, Simon the Zealot in Luke's accounts. So this is the same person. all right. The Zealots were a fanatical sect of Judaism that sought to overthrow Rome, and they reached their prominence in the late 60s. And then finally, Judas Iscariot. Perhaps outside of the first three, the one who's talked about the most in Scripture, particularly in the Gospel accounts. And the reason is he's the one who betrays Jesus. He is always listed last in these accounts. Iscariot likely means that he was from a town called Kerioth, which is in the southern part of Judea. And then the last point here in verse 19, it mentions that they go into a house. All 13 of them enter a particular house in verse 19. All right. I wanted to get through all 12 of them. And I think I did that. next week, we'll look at another section that's titled here, Answering Critics. And it will look at his own people come and call him crazy. And so we'll look at that a little bit next week.